Chapter 7 Brother Anselm and the Pessimist. Section 1 "Ooh!" gasped the cripple. Brother Anselm had wheeled him to the garden terrace behind the café, a grassy plateau fronted by a low stone parapet over which they were now peering down into the depths beneath. The wall of rock, on which they were literally perched in midair, ran down some 1,000 feet sheer into a black gulf of pine tops. Over their needle points, birds wheeled in dizzy circles. Beyond and below again, the gray-green stretches emerging from the dark of the pinery ran down and down, sloping away to the far-off plains of Italy. Here and there, the eye could pick out the white thread of the winding road. Flanking the expanses of the valley and soaring up into the white of their snows, the alpine monsters stood, cold and calm and strong, mighty sentinels keeping guard of the plains below. And over all the blue of heaven swelled, and slowly swooped and melted in the distant haze. The cripple gazed upon the vastness of it all. The arrival of coffee and cakes broke the spell. One of the little tables which stood about was placed at his side. Brother Anselm did host, and poured out the coffee. "Shall we ask our friend to join us?" "What friend?" said the cripple. Brother Anselm pointed with his coffee cup to a melancholy figure sitting at the other end of the terrace. The cripple looked and recognized the pessimist. "Good gracious!" he exclaimed. "So it is! He's come up here to be miserable. Yes, let's ask him. But he's not exactly cheerful, you know. He's got extraordinary views, too." Brother Anselm went across, exchanged the usual courtesies, and returned with the pessimist, who was evincing mild surprise at their presence. "I've just been apologizing for you," said the cripple. The pessimist attempted a smile. He was wondering whether any reference would be made to the other's abrupt return from the hotel. He had not seen him since and was puzzled by his cheerfulness. He was inwardly relieved when no mention was made of the matter, and proceeded to lapse into his wonted gloomy silence. "When's the funeral?" grinned the cripple. "Don't look like that. You'll spoil the landscape. How does that view strike you? Expand on it. Don't keep it all to yourself." "I've no small talk," said the pessimist discouragingly. "Well, unburden your soul. Give us your depressions of life." "Don't take any notice of him," interposed Brother Anselm. "He's light-headed. He's in love. I'll get a muzzle for him." The monk was wondering how best to draw out this gloomy being. He knew something already of the man's depressions of life. He determined to discover more of them if he could. He ventured, "The optimist gave us his views on life the other day. I would very much like to know yours. I should be genuinely interested to hear them. Tell me what you think of the view, and then tell me what you think of life." "Yes," said the cripple. "Let's be miserable."
"If you wish," replied the pessimist to Brother Anselm's request. "I never waste words on inane insincerities, and I shall not do so now. I look upon that view as I look upon all that is beautiful. I look upon it as a mockery of the hideousness of life."
Even Brother Anselm was startled at the abrupt declaration.
"If life is hideous, then beauty is mere mockery, I agree."
"But why hideous?"
"Because it is one long torture of unfulfilled hopes. At its best, the world is a fool's paradise. At its worst, a slough of despond. You ask me what I think of life? I think life is one huge failure. I am, frankly, a pessimist. The end of all our efforts is to find happiness. Do we ever find it? We strive and strive, and are baffled at every turn. The conditions of human existence are such that I can see no possibility of life being other than it ever has been, a veritable martyrdom of man."
"You refer," said the monk, "to what are commonly called physical and moral evils? You mean these evils are so overwhelming as to render man's lot more or less unbearable?"
"Just so. I would go even further. I would say that the dominant quality in life is evil. I would say that existence itself is evil, that existence is a thing to be abolished."
"Why don't you take poison?" asked the cripple.
"Because," proceeded the pessimist, without a vestige of humor, "there is an even worse evil than existence, and that is the will to live. My existence affords me the opportunity of inducing my fellow beings not to will to live." And supposing the whole human race wills not to live? Brother Anselm pressed him. When it does, then the day will come to which we pessimists look forward, the day when the human race will cease to propagate itself and die out. To the day! The cripple raised his coffee cup. Brother Anselm studied the gloomy being before him. He understood that he was expected to take all this seriously. He asked, How many people are there who think as you do? I know Schopenhauer and Hartmann proclaimed pessimism as a philosophical theory, but it was not a very successful venture, was it? You could scarcely say it caught on. I admit that there are, alas, very few genuine pessimists. Have you ever thought why? I imagine because most people prefer their fool's paradise. Hardly, said the monk. The human race could not everlastingly fool itself. If happiness were unattainable, men would cease to seek it. Why should they so persistently pursue happiness? Don't you think the very search points to its existence somewhere, to its attainment somehow? I don't see that it points to more than the fact that most men are fools. It points to very much more, if your theory is true. If this perpetual quest for happiness is the fool's errand you make of it, the men are worse than fools. They are mad. For it means that human beings have acted irrationally throughout their whole history in a matter vitally concerning their well-being. No, you must reduce your scheme of thinking to its logical conclusion, the perpetual insanity of the human race. Call it that, if you like, said the pessimist. His theories were being pressed further than he cared. Right. Then the essential sanity of the human race, which is an axiom of philosophy, is to go. The only sane people are pessimists, and the world is a lunatic asylum, with pessimists for the keepers. Would you subscribe to that? The other saw the quandary. Hang on, Gloomy, hang on, goaded the cripple. Brother Anselm spared an answer. May I make one or two remarks about your ideas themselves? Certainly. There was a suggestion of relief. Well then, may I suggest that you pessimists are suffering from an obsession? The obsession that evil is the all-pervading thing in this world. It is not. There is just as much, if not more, good than evil. You are so obsessed by your exaggerated notion of evil that you cannot see the good. All the pain and suffering and disease, all the physical evils in the world, cannot obliterate the natural happiness inherent in life. Life spells happiness as well as pain. There is health and vigor as well as disease and corruption. There is joy as well as suffering. The mother's joy, the lover's joy, the joys of married love. The very senses of the human body convey innumerable delights. The scent of flowers, the melodies of music, the loveliness of nature, the feel of wind and sunshine. The very intellect of man is a reservoir of gladness. The artist delights to create, the scholar to learn, the scientist to discover. Turn where you will, you cannot fail to find happiness of life as well as pain. I cannot deny that, said the pessimist. I admit that there is a transitory happiness which men squeeze out of life. But how long does it last? The joys you mention are but colored bubbles. When grasped, they burst, and life once more is emptiness. True. Of worldly happiness, the monk replied. The things of earth perish. They cannot permanently satisfy. But why should that make men despair? Why shouldn't it be a stern reminder that permanent happiness lies elsewhere? You pessimists demand of this world what it can never give, what it was never meant to give. When your demand is refused, you find refuge in despair and turn upon life. In other words, you sulk. The other retorted hotly. If there were a guarantee of permanent happiness somewhere, then there would be no cause for complaint. If there were a guarantee, exclaimed Brother Anselm. Look here, you and your co-pessimists are not so blind as all that. You know well enough that there is such a thing in this world as the Catholic Church. You can't overlook her. She's too big, too unique. You must know that she guarantees the very thing you ask of life, the very thing you blame the world for refusing. But have you so much as glanced at her guarantee? Have you even examined her claims? She comes open-handed. She shows her credentials. For 2,000 years, her millions have satisfied themselves that she can do what she promises, lead them to full, unending happiness. Until you take the trouble to inquire of her, your complaint is a sheer pretense. I'm sorry, but you brought this on yourself. I simply couldn't let your remark pass.
Pretense?
The pessimist looked hurt.
Yes, pretense. I use the word deliberately. I want you to see the insincerity, conscious or unconscious, of the pessimistic attitude. It is insincere to ignore the Catholic Church when she offers the very thing you ask for. It suggests that pessimism is a mere posture. When you can come to me and say, there's no guarantee of any final happiness, the Catholic Church lies. I have proved her claims false, her promises a hoax. If you ever come and look me in the face and say that, then I will say to you, you may go now in all sincerity and wallow in your slough of despond.
Section 2. Insofar as the pessimist enjoyed anything at all, he enjoyed a discussion, provided it was confined to vague generalities. But Brother Anselm would not allow any vagueness. His direct method of driving home concrete facts and realities was decidedly disconcerting. Brother Anselm had a way, too, of looking into you while he did it. You found yourself penetrated by a pair of deep-set gray eyes, compelling you to be perfectly honest with him, and with yourself. He had flung a challenge, and a pessimist knew it for a fair challenge. The Catholic Church gave the lie to pessimism. Her assertions could not be swept aside as beneath consideration. She was too potent a factor in the lives of men for that. He knew enough of her to know that she did make life worth living for her millions. She not merely said a thing, she did it. She sent her thousands daily into eternity, radiant with hope. Existence is a thing to be abolished. His declamation suddenly sounded hollow and melodramatic. He was glad the monk had ignored it.
Your despondency ruminates, the cripple broke in upon these considerations.
I am unwillingly admitting to myself that Brother Anselm's challenge is a fair one, replied the pessimist. I am going to put an equally fair one to him, a sort of counter-challenge. He turned to the monk. You admit there is a vast amount of pain and suffering and evil in the world, physical and moral evils you called them, and according to you, God is the cause of all things. He is therefore the cause of these evils. Would you then tell me why you call him a good God? Brother Anselm picked up the glove without hesitation. There is no question, in any case, of God not being good. If God were not good, there would be no such thing as goodness in the world. Goodness can only come from God. There's nothing else for it to come from. Also, if God were not good, he wouldn't be God. God is infinite being, and must therefore contain within himself all the perfections of being in an infinite degree. If there is goodness in creatures, as I imagine even you would admit, then there must be infinite goodness in God. He must be infinitely good.
But that's metaphysics, exclaimed the pessimist, alarmed.
Of course it's metaphysics. Why not? Metaphysics is the science of putting your mind right on these matters, just as physics are the right thing for putting your liver right. Most of the wrong thinking of today is due to the neglect of metaphysics. However, that's by the way. And it doesn't answer my challenge.
Give me a chance, smiled the monk. I want to answer your points in the right order.
Now comes your question of God being the cause of all things, including evil. My answer is, evil is not a thing.
Not a thing? What do you mean?
It is not a thing in itself. Brother Anselm suddenly stood up. He proceeded to place his big figure between the line of the sun and the pessimist, so that his shadow fell on him. Now look, is my shadow... Watch him, Gloomy. It's all done by kindness from the ambulance. Is my shadow, in which you are sitting, a thing in itself? The pessimist looked perplexed.
I must confess, I'm in the dark.
Because I'm in the light, said Brother Anselm. I am an obstacle in the way of the sun. You are sitting in an absence of sunlight, called a shadow. The shadow is not a thing in itself. It is an absence of light. The monk sat down. Applause from the cripple.
Got it, Gloomy? See if you can do it.
You'll be smacked and taken home in the pram, said Brother Anselm. Now, evil is like that shadow. God does not cause evil any more than the sun caused that shadow. Neither is evil a thing in itself any more than the shadow is. God radiates nothing but goodness, just as the sun radiates nothing but light. But he allows obstacles to get in the way of his goodness. And then what happens? You get an absence of goodness, called evil.
Then God allows evil?
The pessimist sounded more hopeful. Certainly, but, mind you, in the physical realm this absence of goodness is not strictly an evil at all. It is merely a failure to attain perfection. Disease is a failure to attain perfect health. Why shouldn't there be failures in nature? This universe is finite and therefore limited in perfection. I would go even further. Why shouldn't this world be all the better for some things failing? Why shouldn't it be all the better for pain and suffering? Don't you think the Christian revelation gives us a glimpse of the immense value of suffering? If it is true, of human suffering, yes, but not of animal suffering. How do you know animals do suffer? Said Brother Anselm. Certainly they do not know pain as we do. Their bodily organization is far simpler than ours. Neither have they rational minds like ours to intensify pain. They are not self-conscious like us. The yelping of a dog being whipped does not necessarily mean pain. It may merely mean a reaction to what is bad for its body. Animal suffering is enormously exaggerated. Judged by the sentiments of some people, animal life might almost be a cruel joke. Normally, it is anything but painful. It is rapturously happy. However, when it comes to the question of why animals should suffer at all, if they do, then I admit that, beyond teaching self-preservation, the place of animal suffering cannot be seen clearly. Suffering, all suffering, is a mystery. I don't deny it. That, of course, is merely because we don't understand God's eternal plan. Our understanding is very limited. All the more reason for trusting the Almighty. Said the pessimist. That seems to me like asking people to shut their eyes to what is evil in the plan and go on trusting blindly. No. The reverse. I'm trying to open your eyes to see what is not evil in the plan, pain and suffering. At the same time, I am certainly asking you to accept the limitations of your finite mind, if you call that trusting blindly. It is the world that shuts its eyes to evil, moral evil, sin. Brother Anselm paused. Now this is what I want to say. Sin is the only real evil. That is not in the plan, but in man. God could not plan sin. If he could, he would be the cause of it, as your challenge implied. Sin is man's rejection of God. God could not will the rejection of himself. He cannot be the cause of sin. The pessimist stuck to his guns. But if he is the cause of man, he is the cause of what a man does. That depends, said the monk. God is the cause of man, yes. He is the cause, too, of man's free will. Also of what a man is intended to produce, goodness. But he is not the cause of man's failure to produce goodness, called sin. Sin is man's failure, not God's. It is due to the misuse of man's free will. The pessimist considered. No, he said. Perhaps I was wrong. You don't ask people to shut their eyes. You ask them to shut their mouths. It was his first attempt at humor. Brother Anselm laughed. In the sense of not opening them to criticize the Almighty, yes. The pessimist considered again. You people have no occasion to criticize. You have faith. Faith, of course, is everything, replied the monk, and it is given to all who ask. But even faith does not solve every problem. It enables us to assent to what God has revealed. It is not an open sesame to all the problems of life. We Catholics might start criticizing the deity for not revealing more. What happens to unbaptized infants? God has chosen to leave their lot veiled in mystery. Are we then to become suspicious? Are we to shake our fists at heaven? Such an attitude would not be merely blasphemous. It would be stupid and irrational. God created those babes solely out of love. He created them to be immortal. Cannot we trust their immortal state to the love that gave them being? That is only one example. You see what I mean? We simply must trust. Any other attitude would be folly. There are problems then for all? The pessimist's attitude was softening. No, answered Brother Anselm. There are no problems for anybody, really. How do you mean? There are no problems for God, because he understands. There are no problems for us, because we are not meant to understand, at present. The only problems are those men make for themselves. Brother Anselm put his hand on the other's shoulder. These are mysteries, though, and one of them is a shadow that falls upon the earth. It was that shadow, at its darkest, that fell upon him who made the earth. He has never allowed that shadow to fall upon his children as it fell upon him. He has never asked them to suffer what he suffered himself as man. Don't you think he understands? Don't you think we may leave his creation to him?"
The pessimist walked across to the parapet and stood there with his arms folded. He remained wrapped in thought. Suddenly, he turned round and faced the cripple. "I want to ask you something extremely personal. I am slow to change my opinions. A comparatively brief discussion is not sufficient justification for doing so. Whether I change them eventually may depend a good deal on you, on what you say now. Of course, you may not care to answer me." "I'll answer you on one condition," the cripple replied.
"Yes?"
"That you will free yourself from the influence of a certain person. I've decided to do so myself. You know whom I mean." The pessimist thought for a moment. He had seen that malicious influence at work, and its effects.
"Yes, I can promise that."
"Fire away, then."
He took stock of the cripple, and then said, "My question may be embarrassing to you, but your answer may be enlightening to me. It is this. You are a test case for my theory of life, if I may put it like that. You are one of life's victims. You, if any, I should say, have cause to despair. Now does my idea of life ring true to you? Now does it?" The cripple replied without hesitation. "No, it does not. It rings false, utterly false. I must admit, I'm ashamed of it, that I did adopt the policy of despair at first, partly under influence. But somebody worked day and night to save me from myself, and he's done it. Despair is the refuge of cowards and shirkers. I'm certain of it. It demoralizes. It unmans. Paralyzes. It draws out all that is worst in a man. It made me behave like a low-down cad. The slough of despond has become loathsome to me." "Brother Anselm's, strong personality has undoubtedly influenced you. I can certainly see that."
"It isn't only that," said the cripple. "It's what he says. It appeals to me, to my reason. It rings true. You wonder if it is true. I believe it is. I only know that it has made life worth living again. I've sort of put my hand in God's, and I'm happy."
The pessimist's reply was checked by Brother Anselm. "Don't say now, whether you believe me or not, my, strong personality might influence your decision. Instead, tell me what made you a pessimist."
"The war," replied the other.
"Funny," said Brother Anselm. "It made me a monk."
The cripple pricked up his ears. "Were you in the war?"
"I was. Battery doctor. Gunners," replied Brother Anselm.
"Good gracious! You never told me. I say, we must have a powwow about all this. Did you get through all right?"
"Looks like it."
"Did you get knocked out?"
"Rather. Inside out. All to bits. Brought back in a jug."
"No, but seriously."
"Well, hardly knocked out. I was wounded, though."
"How?"
The cripple stopped short. There was a look about Brother Anselm which told him not to ask more. He felt mystified. It was the second time the monk had pulled him up like this. They drove back in the twilight down the long winding road. Nearing the monastery gates, another car overtook and passed them in a whirl of dust. But not before Brother Anselm had caught a glimpse of its occupant, leaning forward to observe the cripple on his stretcher. It was the atheist. There was an unpleasant smile on his face. The monk did not like that smile. He did not tell the cripple whom he had seen.